We're doomed, we're saved.
The BioRevolution Podcast.
Your hosts, Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler. We are doomed, we are saved. This time, I believe, Easy, it's episode 21, right? Wow, quite a bit.
Our podcast comes of age today.
Yes, it does.
Or in
we
the US.
We have to rethink it, probably. Cell rejuvenation, resetting the biological clock, we called it. I remember we had a longevity episode a while ago with the motto, who wants to live forever, citing, of course, Freddie Mercury's famous Highlander title song. Today we could go with Alphaville, forever young, I want to be forever young. But let's skip the singing and start talking. Easy, you brought quotes, and much more than that, you brought guests.
Yes, I'll start with the quotes and then I'll introduce our guests. I'm very pleased to have two experts on the field of cell rejuvenation with us today. So we have two quotes, both come from the realms of literature, not from the realms of science. So one is from the famous German writer Goethe, who said, we must always change, renew, rejuvenate ourselves, otherwise we harden, which I think is actually a very nice metaphor also for cell rejuvenation. And the other one is more when we think a little bit about the outlook of what it could actually mean to be able to consistently renew or rejuvenate ourselves, which comes from the curious case of Benjamin Button. It's a story from F. Scott Fitzgerald, where the hero reverse ages. So he starts his life as an old person and then reverse ages. And there, I think that's maybe also puts it into perspective. You're meant to lose the people you love. How else would you know how important they are to you?
Wow. Yeah.
So now I would like to introduce also our guests, Jürgen Rees and Hartmut Geiger, who are experts in the field of cell rejuvenation. And maybe I could hand over to you to introduce yourselves.
My name is Jürgen Rees and I'm a physician by training. And I'm CEO of a small biotech, which spun off out of the research that was done by Hartmut and colleagues since the last 15 years.
My name is Hartmut Geiger. I'm stem cell rejuvenation expert for the last 10, 15 years based on the research we have done. So I'm director of the Institute of Molecular Medicine at Ulm University and co-founder of the company Monkling Bio that Jürgen was talking about. So our focus is on rejuvenating stem cells, blood cell-forming stem cells, and other types of stem cells. And I think we come to that in a while, why that is so important and why we can really claim rejuvenation is close to being translated into a real product.
Let's transfer Goethe, Easy, and Fitzgerald, as you mentioned, and pop culture into science, to biology. It appears to be a given we age, we die due to deterioration of our cells. Now you're invited to say, no, not so fast. And of course, we would like to know a little bit about the lay of the land. Where do we stand right now? Why do we age?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically the million-dollar question. Why do we age? And do we even have to age? I mean, that's even more important. So, I mean, intuitively, it seems, of course, we must age. And there's this very famous theory of aging, the wear and tear theory, where it's just the body is a machine and over time we accrue some damage here and there and then just everything breaks down because it's not meant to be a perpetuum mobile. But there is one caveat to this theory, which is that we are actually able to create new young life from our bodies. So we have the gametes, so the egg and sperm cells, which are able to create a young embryo. It's not like we transfer our biological age to the next generation. So in principle, there must be a way to rejuvenate. Can we tap into that and actually translate that to our whole organism?
So I think that's a really important point to make. So biology has given us tools to not age. We should never forget this. So in certain settings, there are ways that we don't age as a population, so we could harvest that for the individual. I think that's the point really to be aware of.
Yeah, and we have, I mean, this, and I think we'll get into that, of course, in much more detail with the stem cells, but we have our own repair systems in our body. We have cells that are able to replenish our tissues. how can we make them more durable, and then we might not have to age. I think what's actually quite fascinating is that there is, of course, also this, and I think we'll get to that in the end, more societal or general philosophical component to the question of aging. Because, I mean, in ancient philosophy, it was actually thought that people have to age and then die to make room for the next generation. And I think in early Darwinian philosophy, that really resonated, this idea that, I mean, you need to sacrifice basically the older individuals for the good of the group. But evolutionary, that's not really true, right?
No, that's the point. At least in my opinion, there is no, let's say, after reproduction, there is no selection anymore in the system. So there's actually no pressure. Just in basic biological terms, there's no pressure to be counter-selected against aging per se. So again, there might be ways to fix that.
Yeah, so basically, I think we could say there is biologically not really a need to age. Maybe that's a bit too much to say, but for sure there are ways to maybe circumvent it to a certain extent.
Yes, I think there's no pressure on the system that we need to age. I think, and that's probably good to know, because then it's maybe just something of nature. It could be simply wear and tear, but if you find ways to fix that a little bit, then there is no pressure on the other side to stop that.
So let us try to get that straight a little bit, because I'm the non-scientist at the table. Just curious to know, we know such a lot about the human genome. We here in We're Doomed, We're Saved, we talk about the breathtaking speed of advancement in bioscience all the time, in pharma and medicine. Yet my understanding now is, don't really know everything why and how we age. Why is that?
Because I think, I mean, and that's my view, I'll hand over to the experts afterwards, but I think, I mean, we don't know as much as we think about the biology of humans and model organisms, and we're learning with light speed, but we don't know everything. And I think one of the key components that we have not disentangled is the question, what's nature and what's nurture? So how much do the genes contribute, and how much does a lifestyle or the environment, or also the epigenome, I think we'll get into that, contribute to aging, but also all other biological factors. And I think that makes it very tricky to really get to the root causes.
Mm. So I think current research is also not even clear on the genetic and the non-genetic component of aging, but I think rough estimates are between 25 and maybe 50% are genetics. So you're born with a certain set of genes or DNA, and that determines in part maybe your health, how you get older, your lifespan. But it also means best case 75%, worst case 50% are open to doing something with it, because it's difficult to change your genes. But I think that's what you're saying, so nurturing. So what we do, how we do, and how we can intervene is open to this 50-75%, and that's a lot. I think that's a lot.
So up to 75% we can actually influence by living healthier,
being vegetarian, running marathons.
I don't know if these are the solutions. If you believe some proponents of the biohacking or the so-called longevity community, you have to take, I don't know, 200 prescription medication that you're not supposed to take per day, starve yourself, take ice baths, and I don't know what else is on the agenda at the moment. But I think it really depends what this healthy lifestyle could be. But I think there are for sure some, let's say, some tropes that are generally true. And I think these relate to the very classical diet and exercise, right?
In part, I would agree, but there's also a part, I think we need to have also interventions at the end. We cannot really have lifestyle only, because there are a couple of things we can probably not fix with lifestyle. We would need some type of interventions, be mostly maybe drug-based at the end. But I think the combination will be very important at the end. Lifestyle and certain ways that this wear and tear is not modified by lifestyle simply. But both of them are very important, I think.
I think one important point is it's not just about the fact to prolong life. It's about to prolong a healthier life, which is very important. It's not that we want to, let's say, expand misery situations, but we want to prevent diseases. And we all know the older people get, the higher is the likelihood that they get certain diseases, be it cancer, be it cardiovascular events like stroke and these kind of things.
Yeah, I think that's a super important point to raise. Of course, it's not about just making us live longer, but then not have any quality of life at all due to aging-related diseases, but also to actually increase the healthy lifespan and the, let's say, enjoyable lifespan.
And that's obviously something that not only the individual is interested in, but the health systems and the policies behind them. You know, because if I imagine that I go into a retirement at 65 or something and get chronically sick by, say, 70 or 68 and live until I'm 83, that's quite expensive, isn't it?
It is, yes. But maybe we can focus back a little bit on what you discussed initially, you know, what is going wrong with aging first. And most of you might have heard about these hallmarks of aging that are publicized now widely and used. And you can list a lot of them, and they go from proteostasis, sensing, dysfunctions of certain parts, also stem cell exhaustion, I think we'll come to that, and so on. But the interesting part is they are phenotypes, but we do not have a good idea in general why that is they age, so that you don't have the right understanding yet how to tackle them, either by nutrition lifestyle or by pharmacological or drug intervention to really make that better. And that's a lot of research and a lot of money is flowing into them to reset them, also the epigenetic part, for example. So as was mentioned, again, we're at the beginning of understanding them. We know what to look for, I guess, but we have not that into our hands yet fully, what we want to look for at the end.
Maybe a question to the both of you. Do you think there's like a single underlying root cause that causes all the others? So let's say one cause to rule them all, or do you think it's really just parallel processes that just happen next to one another? So these really, I mean, a lot of these hallmarks that you just mentioned are related to this wear and tear, so just accumulating damage, deregulation of many systems. Would you say there is something underneath all of that that we just haven't uncovered yet? Or would you say it's more that it's just a very complex system and a lot of things happen at the same time?
So I have one basic idea to that, which stems from our research, but let's see how this is. It's not put out there too much yet. So we have figured out that upon aging, a lot of things are disorganized in a 3D fashion. So we call it disorder of components within cells and within systems. Because the cell is a very complicated thing, it has a 3D setup. And that's like a lot of Lego blocks, you can think, you know, and a cell has 30,000 Lego blocks. Now you can just put them on a pile and say, this is a cell, or you need to organize them in a structure. You build a house, a cell. And upon aging, it looks like that a lot of these parts are not where they are anymore. So have a little bit, the windows are probably not properly placed, or the machines inside don't work properly because they're misplaced. And a lot of the things we see could be simply due to, like my desk now here, it's not fully disorganized, but it's not that I easily find the paper I was looking for. And if I clean up, that could become very interesting again. That is something still needs to be tested, but I have more and more the feeling that could be at least one more general mechanism that is underlying a lot of these additional dysfunctions that you see upon aging. We are currently testing some of these hypotheses, but again, it's a hypothesis for right now. But could become interesting.
And if I may, let's say this is not scientifically, but let's say for me, this is too complex that we will find at the very end one root cause, which is the, let's say, epiphania of, for the biologists, what is the root cause of aging. This is multi-causal, and that's the reason why it's not so easy to fix.
I would agree. That would be my view as well, that there's probably this multifactorial.
I'd be interested in one, if you mentioned the hallmarks of aging, there's also early talk about longevity genes even. Can you say something about that? Because, of course, this sounds like a holy grail, again, for the non-scientist.
Yeah, maybe I can hand over.
This is a complicated story, as a lot of in biology. So what people have done is they looked at people that live very long and did screening for these genes. You have different modifications of these genes, versions of these genes, and they're associated with people living longer. And the interesting part is, and there was a big push like a couple of years ago, it's very difficult to define the system where they could play a role in. So that has been halted for quite some while, so you can find something that is linked to, but it's very difficult to connect it in a causative way to these differences in aging or being living longer. So this is still up for grab. I don't say that there is not a clear connection, but the gene world and the phenotype world and mechanistic world has not come perfectly together yet. So that's a big mystery to me too, and I wish I could have the answer, but there seems to be no answer to that for right now.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting, I mean, there are also this, of course, so-called longevity genes in model organism that, I mean, in general have a shorter lifespan than humans. And also it's often genes like that play a role in metabolism that would make these animals be smaller or be less metabolically active, which of course in a nice lab environment where it's warm and cozy would make them live longer. But if they were out in the wild, they would probably not survive a single day. So I think there's also a trade-off, I mean, in which condition you would live longer had you this genetic variant that might make you live longer.
Yes, yeah, so that's also a part. We study a lot on these model systems, including animals. And we think we can transfer a lot of this information, but sometimes I think it's still very difficult, as you say. Living your whole life in a nice habitat, in a laboratory, is different from real life, I guess, and that might have different consequences, especially if you measure the lifespan at the end.
Let's try to move on. And I mean, in fashion and lifestyle, the talk of the town is like 60 is the new 40, which of course doesn't have anything to do again with science. But there's a look at the biological clock and the chronological age as well, if you want to dig into that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So I think, I mean, by the way, nice of you to say.
I mean,
as a 60-year-old.
Yes, I'm happy to live in 2024, by the way. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think, I mean, this question of biological and chronological age, so it's a measure of how old you are or how much time you might still have of your healthy lifespan, does not necessarily translate just to the years of life that have passed for you. But it's very difficult to measure. So what's the biological measure of age? And there are some theories around that, so-called biological clocks, that could be quite interesting as markers there. I don't know if that's something you would like to allude to a little bit.
Let's say, again, as a non-really expert on on these age clocks, when I, started to get into that field, I have to admit that I was confused, because each and every scientist come up with his own clock, and then they come up with clocks that are specific for certain organs. So there is not one for one human individual, but for different organs. And I have to say, this is still kind of not clear to me. So, Hartmut.
I think it's very important that we have the separation between biological age and chronological age. And initially it was actually done at just simply, for example, for people looking at people, because initially that was still the best one. Yeah, you could have 10 people and say, you know, they're older, they're younger, they feel biologically younger, and especially in clinical settings, it has been very good. So if the nurse said, you know, he's 60. He should be able to do that procedure without any problem. But I'm not sure, you know, because then there was this perception, this is not 60, it's 80. And usually they were right, you know. Afterwards, people had huge issues. They would say now they're biologically older than their chronological age afterwards. But then people figured out how, what kind of markers do we have, and they settled with, at the end again, this epigenetic toolbox, which is methylation of DNA at this point, and a certain type of methylation on DNA, to explain very simple. And then you have this, and you can correlate it to chronological age, and then you have deviations from that. Then you say people might be older or younger in a certain biological sense. And people are racing towards confirming that hypothesis or assumption. And it turns out this is probably the best tool we currently have to make real statements about biological age. You can also look at protein distribution and things like that. So all the phenotypes you have, your aging, you start to correlate, and then you say deviations from that do define a biological age, and we're getting better at that. I think we're not fully there yet, as Jürgen said, because then the subgroups do single, so in theory there should be one, but there are multiple ones now. But overall, I think we're getting closer to defining that. It's very important if you want to design or have target interventions, being nutrition or something like that, because you want to know, am I moving in the right direction?
Yeah, because I think that's also one of the key challenges, right, when studying aging, but also when devising interventions in biotech and pharma. I mean, how do you measure aging as an endpoint? Because if you would have to wait 20, 30, 50 years until the person is aged to see if the treatment that you did when they were 30 has an effect, I mean, that's not really a feasible model, right? So having a short-term endpoint that tells you something, or a marker that tells you something about the biological age a person might have, is actually, I think, quite helpful, right?
I think one important point is that's one of the difficulties in the whole field of, let's say, developing molecules to prevent aging or to rejuvenate. It's the fact that, of course, you need these biomarkers, these surrogate parameters. Otherwise, it will be almost impossible to run confirmatory large-scale studies. On the other side, aging on its own is not yet accepted as a disease or an indication for which a molecule can be developed. So all the companies that are in that field have to identify one role model disease where they can test their hypothesis in order to show, okay, it does something good in a certain subpopulation, and then potentially test it in other populations with the final goal that at the very end, potentially, we move steadily but slowly into something that could really be approved, quote-unquote, to prevent aging.
And also, some of the clocks are really now used in, let's say, in the first set of clinical trials. So for example, Singapore is running initial trials on healthy interventions, and they start using these clocks as endpoints, as their short-term endpoints. I think there will be much more information coming out of that more controlled fashion of running trials to actually really see then in the long run whether they're really good endpoints. But again, I think it's moving in the right direction to have a tool at hand to start planning interventions.
So in times of mythology, in ancient times, we had the fountain of youth, and now we have kind of witness or are in the midst of developing and in the quest for life prolonging treatments, as you just mentioned. Where do we go from here? Where's the most promising part of it in your mind, Izzy?
That's, I mean, again, the not million, but billion dollar.
Billion. I understand, yeah.
What's over billion, trillion dollar question, of course? What's the most promising route? As we saw before in the discussion about how difficult it is to identify the root cause of aging, as difficult will it be, I mean, to find really the pathway or the molecular process to bet on to find the right intervention. And there are some large-scale trials for molecules that have been identified serendipitously to have some effect on aging. I think they mostly play roles in a lot of different pathways, but related to metabolism, nutrient sensing, and immune modulation. So they're rapamycin and metformin. I think rapamycin is tested in a big dog trial and some smaller human trials, and metformin, I think, in this large human trial, which I think hasn't produced results yet, but there are some not completely proven hints that those might prolong life on a long run. But there are a number of very different routes. Some of them relate, for example, to cell rejuvenation. We'll get into that in a second. But there are also other avenues that one might take, for example, removing cells that are not functional anymore, so senescent cells from tissues using so-called senolytics, modulating epigenetics, so what we just talked about in these clocks. So these are epigenetics, like in a very brief explanation, are the whole cellular system that surround the expression of genes. So anything that relates to how genes are expressed. So we have the same DNA in almost all our body cells, but they are very different. Mm-hmm. So, and the reason for that is epigenetics. So any deregulations of that and many other pathways. But maybe I can hand over to our experts to dive a little bit deeper into what they find most promising along the routes of longevity prolonging treatments.
I think one important topic for me is that the normal, let's say, way how drugs are developed, I would say more than 50% are already age-related disease drugs. So if we are developing a drug against atherosclerosis to prevent a stroke or a heart attack, these are very important developments and they do a lot of good and benefit to patients. But for me, these kind of developments and products do not belong really into the longevity field, because this is treating something which exists in the elderly people. I think if you really get them to, let's say, to the group where they really want to go to the root cause, then the number of approaches is getting much, much smaller. Hartmut.
So this goes along to one part I think we have not mentioned yet. This is this concept of geroscience. Maybe we should start that, is that there's a hypothesis out there that per se aging without any disease is a driving cause for these aging-associated diseases. So that targeting aging-associated is this beneficial part, also in this part aging. On the other hand, there's one layer below that, that is the non-disease aging. I think that's the easiest to explain that. And that if you have access to non-disease aging, you might even tackle a lot of these aging-associated diseases at once. And that's a concept people try to prove or disprove currently in multiple laboratory settings. So you have always this mixture of aging-associated diseases and aging per se in this field. And there are multiple ways to address that, as Jürgen said so far. Coming back to this epigenetic thing, that's probably very promising in multiple levels currently, due to the fact that it falls into this, what I would call, order-disorder system. My analogy is always, analogy is that it's like a library, you know. Epigenetics orders a library. So you have a bookshelf, tons of books in the library, you know where they are and you have access to because it's marked. So it's shelf A, level C, disposition. And then you have access to like gene information. If this is gone, you still have your books, but again, you don't know where they are. And that's probably what epigenetics is doing to our DNA. So in upon aging, there's multiple studies. It's disordered simply in multiple ways. It's not just that part. And there's good approaches from multiple people or multiple labs trying to reorder that epigenetic approach, always included. And that seems to be really helping to get cells functioning, aged cells functioning much better. And that would be very important, and also for stem cells, because they're very critical for how we do tissue homeostasis, which is also usually a first part that's going down upon aging.
Maybe you could mention very briefly what, for example, stem cells in the hematopoietic system, what do they actually do? Why do we need them? And why is it so bad if they fail upon aging?
Good. So we have tissues in our body, organs, that are run by stem cells, adult stem cells that you call them. So each cell is just there for a certain amount of time and needs to be replaced, due to wear and tear. A good sample is the blood system. Most of you know erythrocytes, red blood cells only live for 120 days. And we have cells in our system that only live for a couple of hours, up to days. These are usually immune cells. So if they would live longer, it would be a big problem because they're partially crazy already. And they want to get something to do, attack an antigen or attack something we don't want. And if they don't allow to do that, they'll go crazy. So we restart them every couple of days. And they are all supported by what we call blood cell forming stem cells. It's usually in your bone marrow, in your hips is a good example. And there are just a few of these stem cells. They're vital that you can produce your red blood cells, your white blood cells, and then also your immune cells continuously. If you don't do it, have them, you're going to die. Unfortunate, but example is, for example, if I watched Oppenheimer a couple of days ago, after the atomic bomb, the irradiation destroys your blood-forming stem cells, and people died, I think, 10, 14 days after the bomb came. So that's why you die. You don't have your stem cells anymore. So that's very important. And the other systems, so if they age, they do not do that very well. And a couple of laboratories, including our, could show they are really important when they age to change your immune system, for example. So you don't have a good immune system, at least in part due to aging of your blood-forming stem cells. So an immune system is important. I think a lot of people still die from pneumonia, which is due to or flu or something like that, which is usually due to not having a good immune system. So they are vital for being happy when you're older, healthy especially.
We have to talk about a little bit about philosophy, but also about the new pharma industry, because I can well imagine that this is a game changer, what we're talking about right now.
Yeah. And maybe we can dive into that from the perspective of cell rejuvenation, because I think, or reprogramming, so-called reprogramming, which I think some of the big players in the field that have just been founded in the last couple of years, also with the backup of some, let's say, tech giants are after, but which also I think some of the smaller biotechs are after. So maybe you can comment both on the avenues for reprogramming, but also on the new directions this industry is taking and the challenges that it will also face. Maybe I can hand over to Jürgen first and then to Hartmut for that.
I think one of the biggest topics is, if you want to develop and sell something that prolongs life, such an approach should have zero side effects. Because this is prevention, it's not, let's say, dealing with, let's say, making a bad situation better, but preventing something you never know whether it would actually really happen. This is a big topic. And again, I think it will take the next 10 to 20 years at least, until there is evidence enough regarding the surrogate parameters like the clocks and the like that Hartmut talked about, before an agency would really allow such a molecule to the market. So even if a lot of people say, okay, this is huge and this is fast, it will take some time.
Just coming to the top of my head, can we take any leads from vaccine development? Because, I mean, it's kind of the same situation, right? You want to prevent a disease that's not really there, and you need the buy-in of both the population and the agencies to actually make that happen.
Absolutely. However, the advantage in vaccines is that you see faster effects. I think in the anti-aging field, it will take even longer until you can really prove that there is something good in what you're doing.
I think maybe having some, just how you say, spitballing here, but if you would have some endpoints that relate to physical appearance, like having less wrinkles and less hair graying or something, or hair loss even, that might get a big buy-in, at least from the population as an endpoint. Maybe not so much from the regulators, but...
So I always get asked in my personal environment, when is your drug ready so that I lose my wrinkles and stuff like that? But as Jürgen would say, this is difficult to separate, let's say, cosmetic from pharmacological developments and all of that. And it would be another long-term topic. I think the interesting part is now that you have a group of large players coming in with a lot of money that do want to tackle very basic mechanisms to just start more or less from scratch with basic biology companies. But there's also a lot of now intermediate large, but compared to the other ones, intermediate-sized ventures that push hard for really science-based new developments. And I think that really has been a shift in the last 5-10 years in the field, that now the science starts dominating the move into translation. Before that, sometimes could say it's a bit voodoo-ish here and there, you know, I make an eye like this rejuvenation part of your nose. And we also have start having tools to measure this rejuvenation, for example, with the clocks. But as Jürgen said, you know, no side effects over a long time. That's very difficult to achieve. So the first goal for all of them is currently to target age-associated diseases, because a disease endpoint is easier and then side effects are less complicated. But I think it's a new movement. So, and I think what we also need to come to think about is that that's very important to society, also to think about what it means. So because I checked recently survival curves again, you know, like people look at, you know, we had this strong increase in lifespan, let's say 80, 50 into 90, 50, then it starts to flatten a little bit. But we could be on the verge, you know, with all this new intervention maybe coming soon or later, be it still a decade or something like that, so that we have this strong increase again. I cannot say right now, but it's another possibility. So how do we deal with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, let's try and close this episode exactly with some observations in this direction. I mean, we're approaching on planet Earth 10 billion people in the not so far future. So I think the question also taking into consideration the global north and the global south, can parts of humanity afford a longer life? Does it make sense at all?
That's a good question. I think in general, if we disentangle, and I think what Jürgen said before, which is really important, the lifespan from the health span and affording a longer time of being healthy, I think that would be beneficial for everyone. If it's about just spending more time on the planet, I think there are a lot of questions around that, of course. Maybe I can hand over to Hartmut for that.
That's the, let's say, circular thing here. I think because the deal is to have health span, more health span and not more lifespan per se in most of these interventions, so we target diseases, I think it's per se, first of all, beneficial to each person. Who wants to be sick at the end of life? And everybody would sign on and saying, yes, that's a good thing. Then there's people that saying, and it's also, you know, I've lived my life. I don't want to live 10 years longer, 20 years longer. I've seen everything. Could be changing if you tell them, you know, you can also have a healthier life, you know. And it comes down to people that are more curious about the future, I guess. Do I want to see more of this planet or not? Or am I done with this planet, you know, for a couple of reasons? Good. And that's, I think, a very personal decision. The other part is that you then go into population decisions based on that. And there are different parts here. So for sure, planet is having more people, maybe too many people, but also this is flattening out. I think 10 billion is the maximum. Then predictions are clear. There will not be more due to all these economic developments. It's relatively clear that we have soon a maximum. So then it comes down to societies that have issues that are aging very fast. And there's a movement in these societies to really have larger scale approaches to allow for healthy aging, and that you cannot entangle from living longer. And I don't have any answer to that to myself now too, but this could become also something people need to think about in maybe even systemic terms. So different systems might have different approaches to that. And I also see it's a little bit more like climate change, you know, it's real now. Now, and people have started thinking more like 10, 20 years before, and think, yeah, it could come. But maybe that's the same one, as I said. If you have to shift, it could come also in 10, 20 years being even more present than now, that you can do something about it, and you need to think about how to tackle that as a society, or not just an individual. So I think, and that's very important, that people that support that want to have something that allows everyone to access any type of intervention or technology. And that's, for example, we are very happy in developing our thing further, that we have backup from people that are really, really want to make this available to everyone. And I think that's the big part, and we should look for that, at least that the doc technology is developed, should be available to everyone at the end, and not just some people.
And I think that's very important, that, let's say, our investor, Kisuwu, has really the vision, finally, to have something affordable for everybody on the world. It should not be an extended lifespan only for the rich people. It should be really for everyone, which sounds crazy from the get-go, but I think I'm really happy that we have people who have that vision and spend their own money to, let's say, allow small companies like ours to explore that. And I think over time we will find then, let's say, some approaches will work, some will not work. And this is also expensive, and that these people spend their own money to, let's say, allow this evolution. I think that's also remarkable.
In my ears, it doesn't sound crazy at all. It sounds just beautiful. And at that point, I have to thank our guests. So thank you very much at that point. Izzy, do we know what we'll be talking about next episode already?
Yeah, we do. We'll talk to some folks from the Intervene Symposium about polygenic risk scores and the ethical implications of those. But first of all, I really want to thank our guests today. That was really enlightening on many different levels. Can I maybe finish with one more question, because I'm really interested in a personal aspect. So in preparing for this episode and also the longevity episode, I mean, I always come across this really wide span of what longevity means and this difference between like real science, like what you're doing, and anything from, I don't know, nutrient supplements from algae that make you or whatever things are around. How is it actually to be in this field as a founder, as biotech representatives? And what are the challenges in talking to people? I mean, I made this joke about hair loss before or wrinkles, but this is something you must be facing all the time, right? This kind of like mixture of science and snake oil, let's say.
I think I was very skeptical at the beginning. Become I'm a school medical person, let's say I'm not a visionary, something like that. But what really convinced me is the broad scientific basis of the approach that we in our company are following up. This is data that is published in peer-reviewed journals, so others have looked at it. It's not just a statement that some single individuals believe this is the way everybody should do. And I think that's very careful. If you get in touch with certain statements, just check it, what's the strength of the scientific basis of it, and then take it or leave.
Yeah, I think science needs to be the driver, otherwise nothing. So check the level of scientific confidence in statements.
Then I would say many thanks for being our guests today. Many thanks also to you, of course, for hosting, as always.
Thank you for hosting us. So, our pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
This was episode 21 of We Are Doomed, We Are Saved. If you like the show, subscribe to it. We appreciate your commentary as well. And tell us what you want to hear on the show next time.